Yeah, so 5 past.
Mm-hmm. Sergei is coming.
Okay, yeah, he told me that. Do you know?
He's not in the hallway.
Oh, okay.
David.
Morrison's at the Western Algebraic Geometry Center.
Oh.
Is he talking to somebody?
I don't think.
Okay. So then let's start. It's my pleasure to have Nora Ganta here from Kobe College. She'll be talking about elliptic cohomology, Witten genus, and maybe some application to physics.
Something like that, yes. Well, thank you very much for inviting me here, giving me a chance to speak. So I'm not really sure how to title this, but it's elliptic cohomology. Let's say generalized moonshine. And some connections to physics. Okay. So I'm going to start by giving a short, very, very informal introduction to what elliptic cohomology is, because I don't assume that anybody would really know, although I've been told that the theme of the seminar this semester would involve elliptic cohomology. Okay, let's start by reviewing what the generalized cohomology theory is. And I'm going to do the fast version, which is by pictures. So we have singular cohomology or ordinary cohomology. We have your space. Space X, and you're looking at singular simplices. In this space, and you do something with them to make it an abelian group. The notation is H star of X. Now that the coefficients, so H star of just the 1-point space, are the integers. Now here's the second example, important example of a generalized cohomology theory, which is K-theory, topological K-theory. Again, you can do a definition by a picture. You have here your space X, and the geometric objects that you are considering now are vector bundles over X. So looking at is the number of K of X. It's the group of all complex vector bundle over X, which is not a group. You have a direct sum as addition, but you can take Grothendieck group completion to make it. Mm-hmm. Same concept, you take a topological space, you assign an abelian group, family of abelian groups. Okay, the third important generalized cohomology theory that is also more classical is cobordism theory, complex cobordism. You know that mu star of X Now, there is a geometric interpretation of complex cobordism, but it's a little bit involved to set it up. But if X is a point, you just have the cobordism ring. And you start a point. Complex cobordism ring. Complex cobordism ring. So you have stably almost complex manifolds, which are equivalent if there's a one dimension higher manifold such that its boundary is. So here's this one is equivalent to this one, so it's a typical picture of cobordism. Because I can put a membrane between the two sides. Which is X and X prime as boundary, and there's all sorts of subtleties about orientations and so on that I'm suppressing here. Just trying to give an impression of what would be an equivalence class, what would be an argument of this ring. Yeah? Now, so far I'm sort of assuming that people have at least seen these things before. Yeah? Now, where does the whole story start? These are very topological objects, these are cohomology theories and so on. Now, at some point in the 50s, 60s, I guess, all these notions from algebraic geometry started to, number theory started to find their way into stable homotopy theory, into these generalized cohomology theories. And the key, what was at the heart of all of this, was Quillen's theorem. So there's a theorem due to Quillen, which identifies this cobordism ring as the Lazar ring, the ring that carries the universal formal group law. And one way to state it is like this. So it's going to be about Quillen's theorem. You could define, or people do define, a complex genus as a map out of the cobordism, map of rings out of the cobordism ring. R could be any ring. You say complex genus with values in R. Hmm? Now, Quillen's theorem states that there's a one-to-one correspondence between these complex genera and formal group laws over R. Hmm? Every ring R is such a one-to-one correspondence. I haven't defined what the formal group law is. I will do this by examples in a second. Now, I want to emphasize, though, that we have here two very, very different areas of mathematics that meet in a third one. Yeah? So these complex genera is something that people who are interested in variants of manifolds are interested in. They study manifolds. They want to assign some sort of invariant to it in a nice and natural way. And they studied these genera. Yeah? They do turn up in homotopy theory, which I will describe in a minute, how this is connected to many of these things. Right now, the only connection that we have is that we have here the cobordism ring, right, which is the source of a genus. But there's deeper connections. And now on the other hand of this one-to-one correspondence, we have these formal group laws over R, which are much more algebraic notion. Hmm? Let me give you just some examples of formal group laws. Formal group laws are power series, formal power series in two variables over the ring that satisfy a few axioms. Axioms basically trying to imitate the group axioms. Hmm? Just because I know that people are taking notes, there will be some space in these examples which will be filled in a bit later. So try to leave some space
are
with
you
me.
Are you fixing your space for a given time, or
which space?
When you define a complex genus.
A complex genus is a ring map.
Right, but so you, but right. But
oh, sorry, I'm your star of the point.
Yeah?
Sorry. So just on coefficients. And indeed, in the end, it will turn out to be a natural transformation of cohomology theories that's somehow behind that. Yeah? But right now, no, we just have the cobordism ring here. Thanks. First example of a formal group law is the additive formal group law. And let me put on the other side of the blackboard what the genus is that goes with this one. I've given you a formal group law by Quillen's theorem. There's on the other side of this one, one-to-one correspondence, I should have a genus. This is actually a very boring genus. It sends the manifold M to zero if the dimension of M is greater than zero, and to the number of elements of M if the dimension is zero. Yeah? We can easily check that this is a multiplicative and additive map. Yeah? Now, the second example of a formal group law is the multiplicative formal group law. And the topologists like to parameterize it as x of f of xy equals x plus y minus xy. The genus that goes with it is already much more interesting. So on the side, my genus is the Todd genus. Also known as complex order characteristic. And here's the third example. So both these formal group laws, additive and multiplicative formal group laws, really come, are given to us as formal completion of some algebraic group, and there's a third source of one-dimensional algebraic groups, which are elliptic curves. Yeah? So the third example would be an elliptic curve over R, generalized elliptic curve, which is not too bad. So we could look at the formal completion around the zero section, and it's going to be a formal group. And a genus whose associated formal group law comes from a formal group that belongs to an elliptic curve is called an elliptic genus. Hmm? And the genus, so this is the formal group. Here's a definition. An elliptic genus is a genus together that satisfies, say, I'm a bit sloppy with this definition, but I would drown in technicalities if I wanted to be totally precise. Yeah? That satisfies a formal group of the form completed at zero, where C is an elliptic curve over R. What am I sloppy with? I'm sloppy with a few things. One is that the elliptic curve should really be part of the data. Second thing is that there's a subtle distinction between formal groups and formal group laws, which corresponds to just having the abstract thing or picking a coordinate around zero. Mm-hmm. I want to gloss over this because it will just take time. Okay, so how do we connect this back to generalized cohomology theories, or so-called spectra? Cohomologists like to think about. I already said this earlier when I had the definition a bit wrong on the blackboard with the genus. So really, if you have such a genus, if you have a map from the cobordism ring, which is just cobordism of one point, you'd really like to ask yourself, is there maybe an underlying map that would work just for cobordism of any space and would have as target a different cohomology theories? You would want a natural transformation of cohomology theories. Hmm? And indeed, you have these, at least in the first two cases. So here, there's indeed a map, natural transformation from complex cobordism of whatever to ordinary cohomology of whatever, which if I plug in point, yeah, then I get this genus, which it starts in the cobordism ring and it takes values in the integers. Yeah? For K-theory, also K-theory of a point are the integers. Yeah? And there's also a map from the cobordism ring, the natural transformation from the cobordism ring to K-theory, which is called the Connor-Floyd map. And Connor and Floyd in 66, in their, I think it's a lecture notes paper, where they explain in great detail why on coefficients, if I plug in just the one-point space, the Connor-Floyd map gives us this genus, the Todd genus. Hmm? And they set up actually a lot of the theory as it is done for elliptic cohomologies too, before the time of elliptic cohomology. Now, here. Why is it natural? If you're a homotopy theorist, it seems very natural. Because.
I'm not.
Yeah, I mean, well, one of the things is that we had. Sort of, there's the equivalence theorem is a bit deeper. Yeah? So it's actually really a statement about cobordism, not just a cobordism ring. Yeah? And these formal group laws, I mean, really what is going on here is that these formal group laws, I did a bit of a shortcut to define them with these genera. Yeah? But what's happening is that they describe the multiplicative properties of the first Chern class of a line bundle. So if I have some cohomology theory, this formal group law that gets attached to it, it gets attached to it if and only if I have Chern classes in the theory. Yeah? And the question is, if I have two line bundles, L1 and L2, and I know the Chern classes of these two, then the first Chern class of the product is going to be C1 of L1 plus C1 of L2, where this is a plus in our formal group. Yep. Yeah, this is how the formal group is defined. And this is really works over any space. Yeah? And the formal group law that you actually get, this f of xy, yeah, you can actually get it as from the universal line bundle over CP infinity. Yeah, CP infinity is BU1, mm-hmm. Classifies line bundles. And so over there you get your formal group law. Now if you look at mu star of CP infinity and all these things, you really, I mean, there's something going on the level of spaces. Yeah. There's going to be hopefully an even better reason later on if I get to these overfold genera, where you can say even if you're not a homotopy theorist, it's sometimes nice to be able to work in the homotopy category, because these statements about overfold genera become much less computational than they normally are. So anyways, whether or not you feel that this is a great idea, people in homotopy theory really wanted to do the same thing for elliptic cohomology. Because, well, maybe one thing to say here for the whole Connor-Floyd picture is having these trunk classes goes together with having tome isomorphisms for your theory and all these things. Having all sorts of characteristic classes is really something that you want. Yeah? And then you just get on coefficients, you get this genus. And having tome isomorphisms and so on is really something where you want it for every space, not just a point. Yeah? Now, we are at the point where we can say,
what you just said, but how is existence of Tom isomorphism related to this natural transformation?
Pardon?
How is the existence of Tom isomorphism related to this natural
transformation? Well, it's related to, so we had Coulomb's theorem, which relates such natural transformations, or actually just on coefficients, to formal group laws. Yeah? And if you have Chern classes, then you get the formal group law. And Chern classes are in turn what you need to get the Tom isomorphism. Yeah? So there's a lot of theorems that I'm suppressing, and they have longer proofs. So I'm not going to go into any detail. But if you have if you have some generalized cohomology E, and you take E of CP infinity, and it turns out that is the same as E star, so E star of CP infinity is the same as E star of point formal power series in X, yeah? Then you can get everything else for free. You do get the Tom classes, you get Tom isomorphisms, you get a whole theory of characteristic classes which behave exactly like the Chern classes, just that the tensor product might be governed by a more complicated formal group law. Yeah? And then these formal group laws in turn give you the genera of this natural transformation. There's a whole book written about this in all detail by Rudiak. Okay, I want to emphasize one small word here that people oftentimes are confused about, so let me just say there's no such thing as the elliptic genus. Every older text that you will look at will speak about the elliptic genus or the universal elliptic genus, and there's at least three different accounts in the literature that I've seen of the universal elliptic genus or the elliptic genus, yeah? And it's simply, there's just many of them. Yeah, there's a whole moduli theory of them. So I don't want to go into moduli problems because, again, they get extraordinarily technical, but you can very well just think one elliptic curve at a time. Yeah? And then you should just be ready to speak about an elliptic genus and an elliptic cohomology theory. Let me just put the definition here.
What's going to be the difference between different and elliptic genera?
Pardon? With different elliptic genera?
I mean,
you have different elliptic curves, right?
So you'll vary rings over which they're defined?
Oh, yes. Like? You can vary rings, you can vary elliptic curves.
So the formal
group
will change.
I mean, there's different things also people are interested in. For instance, people are very interested in the Tate K theory, where they have the Tate curve. Yeah. They're very interested in the universal deformation of the supersingular elliptic curve. For some reason, that turns up in homotopy theory. Mm-hmm. Yeah? If you try to compute the homotopy groups of spheres. Yeah? I mean, so there's various, very different setups of what people are actually interested in. In the end, they're interested in the whole moduli problem of, well, elliptic spectra that can be somehow also, so cohomology theories which come together. So an elliptic cohomology theory is a cohomology theory, a generalized cohomology theory, let's call it L, together with an elliptic curve C over L star of point. So it should be a multiplicative cohomology theory.
So the elliptic genus, which is used in physics literature or algebraic geometry, is usually the one for curves over C, right? Over complex numbers.
Yes,
that's kind of universal, right? So
well, that's what whoever speaks about their favorite elliptic genus thinks of them as kind of universal, yeah? But there's different setups how they could be kind of universal, different universal properties that you could look for, yeah?
Well, I could imagine if purpose defined over a number of fields and something interesting happens, like ramification, for instance, then things may jump or behave in a different way.
Yeah. Right?
But first of all, that's something I don't really know, but I wonder if that's related to, if those elliptic genera good for describing some, I'm interested in the fundamental theory.
Yes. I mean,
the one over C definitely is. I mean, it's a refinement of pure supergenus of lots of things, right?
Yes. Oh, you mean the one with two variables,
right.
Q and Y?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. And I mean, I've seen. Yeah,
that's the one I would call the D.
That's one of the ones that I've seen called D.
Right.
Yes. And it's right because it encodes all the Ky-Y genus and all the Holzapfel genera and so on, the level N genera and so on. Yes, but it's not the most universal thing that you could do. And the truth is, there's just not such a thing as a universal elliptic curve, at least if you don't want to speak about stacks. But let me finish this definition. Elliptic cohomology theory is a multiplicative generalized cohomology theory. L, say, that L star point is a ring together with an elliptic curve over that ring. And the natural transformation from the cobordism ring to L, which realizes the elliptic genus, which comes from the completion around zero. Realizing meaning in the same way that the Kronner-Floyd map realizes the Todd genus. Yeah? And the first, so if you look a little bit at the history of elliptic cohomology, in the beginning also people were speaking about elliptic cohomology like one thing because they'd only constructed one example of it. And the genus that they were looking at was Hirzebruch's level 2 genus. Yeah, that's what they built in the beginning. And then people could construct things for all this level N genera. And much more. So people have come up with a big machinery of constructing these. It is a very heavy machinery and not at all geometric. Using very hard homotopy theoretic. Techniques.
It seems like with this sort of general definition, you're already including TMF into.
Well, I'm actually not including TMF because there's no elliptic curve, right? TMF would want to have the universal elliptic curve, right?
Right. But you also want to be so universal.
Right. You want something universal. People keep trying to get somewhere close to the universal. And that's, I think, why they like to look at the Tate curve or at this universal deformation of the supersingular because you get a big part of your moduli stack. Yeah? But in order to get everything, you can't just have one elliptic curve. Right? So, indeed, the way Andor, Hopkins, and Strickland set up a definition of what an elliptic cohomology theory is, it's set up in such a way that TMF is not going to be one, but it is sort of the limit overall, yeah, in a homotopy theoretic sense.
It seems to me that you're kind of preaching.
Pardon?
Right, it seems to me that. Anyway.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
Probably more useful question than to ask is. Putting TMF aside, what's again the usual one with Q and Y, which is big Jacobi form. So, where in that story is that?
This one you can get by some construction from the Tate curve, and I can tell you about it later, because I mean we had to do this for some paper to get this thing actually as an elliptic spectrum, but it's a different story than what I wanted to focus on right now. But yes, it's possible to get that. And you start with a Tate curve, and then you do some stuff. Yeah? And then you have some homotopy theoretic reason for why this thing becomes a Jacobi form and so on. Okay, but I want to get into some applications, and in order to go into some or some applications or some connections to physics or something like that. So in order to go into this, you need to speak a bit more or set up a bit more, but just a little bit. Let G be a finite group. Yeah. Now you could think about equivariant elliptic cohomology, and right now I just want to think about the equivariant elliptic cohomology of a point. Yeah. And this should be compared somehow to K-theory of a point, which is the representation ring of a group. Yeah. Now, this elliptic cohomology of a point, equivariant elliptic cohomology of a point, again, there's many different definitions. One of the very first ones was to say we just take Borel equivariant elliptic cohomology, so we take Borel construction of our space with a group action and apply this, I think what they first applied was the one with the supersingular elliptic curve. Hmm? And they computed this, so they is Hopkins, Kuhn, and Ravenel. They computed this E2 of BG, so one incarnation of elliptic cohomology, and they found that elements of this thing could be described in a way that they want to be characters, like elements of here can be characters, class functions on elements of the group, but these are two characters, or two class functions. So what's a two class function? Instead of plugging in just one element of the group, you plug in two, but they should commute. GH equals HG.
What is
E2? I haven't defined that. It's an incarnation of elliptic cohomology, and this is the one which has the universal deformation of the supersingular elliptic curve. And by the Serre-Tate theorem, the formal group is then the universal deformation of the Honda formal group law. These are called Lubin-Tate spectra, or sometimes Morava E theories. Two is the height, exactly. Because at height 2 is where you're dealing with elliptic curves, right? So at height n, actually, or height h, say, you would have, for n, I've used h here, you have n tuples of commuting elements. Yeah? But for elliptic cohomology, for now, let's just speak about pairs of commuting elements. And you have this behavior where we have like two class functions. They have much more reason to think of them as characters. So you have something like the formulas for the restriction of a induced representation and restriction of a representation and inner product and all these nice things that you have on the representation ring. You have them all here, and they come from topological things such as transfer. So you have a map of groups H to G. You have a map BH goes to BG, and in stable category you get a map in the other direction. It's transfer. Now, if you write down what it does in characters, you know, and compare it with Serre's old book, Linear Representations of Finite Groups, it gives the exact same formula as the induced representation, just that you now have pairs of commuting elements rather than commuting elements. Now, I'm glossing over a lot of stuff here again, because this...
Sorry for asking very difficult questions, but hasn't anybody tried to look at height 3Js with 3 commuting elements, or is it too
what,
weird thing?
What exactly do you mean by work at? I mean, they have proven the theorem that these elements are class functions on triples, commuting triples. Mm-hmm. That's known.
Have something like cohomology theory.
Pardon?
Have something like cohomology theory.
Well, there's E3. So it's the third Morava E theory or Lubin-Tate theory. So E3 of BG. Yes, elements of that will have triples of commuting elements. Yeah? So as there will be class functions on triples of commuting elements. Now here's, again, this is some cohomology theory that you can build using the Landfield by exact functor theorem, actually. It has the width vectors adjoint, all sorts of stuff. Yeah? So you have height 3 deformation theory in there. Now, and you said it has worked on. So here, there's a little bit more of an attempt to get some geometric intuition, because, of course, this is somehow screaming. It wants to have a representation theory going with it, right? You just have the character theory. And here we have some constructions of, if you use two categories, yeah, he has some constructions of how you can get actually these things as characters, representations in two categories. Maybe I should say, since this is the mathematical physics talk, and I've sort of just rushed over this. So we don't have a geometric construction for elliptic cohomology. Yeah? But it exhibits in many ways striking formal similarities to things from concepts from string theory. And the hope is that somehow sigma models and all these things will eventually yield a geometric definition of this. Yeah? So it was not built. Physicists oftentimes, when I speak to them in the beginning, they say, oh, yeah, whatever, we could prove the Stecker from a Valinda-Valinda formula in elliptic cohomology. They're like, yeah, well, of course, because it was probably built to model whatever we were doing already, because that's what mathematical physics often does. Yeah? But here it's a convergence rather than one being built to model the other. So it's a different sort of setup. And it's a bit more surprising sometimes, like, why can you do this? Hmm? Okay, I want to speak now, let's see, we have a few minutes, great. So I want to speak about orbifold genera first, to give a first flavor of how these things connect or they have similarities in physics, and also why it is nice to have the homotopy theoretic setup if you want to speak about orbifold genera. Pretense anymore that I'm giving you a formal definition. I'm just going to tell you what the setup normally looks like. You have an elliptic genus, and it has some sort of equivariant version of this elliptic genus, and you could look, for instance, at the Borel equivariant map. So here you don't actually need an equivariant version, you just use the Borel equivariant version to elliptic cohomology of the classifying space. Yeah? So here is actually already a step where it's useful to have a natural transformation rather than just a map on coefficients, because it tells you actually what we can do equivariantly, Borel equivariantly. Mm-hmm. And typically, the setup for orbifold genera, here we have an equivariant genus. So group G actually plays a role. For instance, it is part of defining the target ring, so we have no chance for this to be independent of the group. For orbifolds, we would like to say, well, if I have a global quotient orbifold like this, it could happen that it's equivalent as an orbifold to a different manifold divided by a different group, and you would like the thing to have the same results. Hmm? Now, typically, your orbifold genus is going to be followed by a map like that. And this map is typically going to look like this chi. So remember, chi in here is a character where you can plug in two elements. It goes to 1 over the order of the group, sum over all pairs of commuting elements in the group, chi of G. H. So the whole thing, let me summarize what I just wrote here. Typically, the definition of orbifold genus somehow looks something like this. Hmm? You can break it up into two parts. One is equivariant, and one is the second part. Now, if you look at this a priori, it looks not very much like Well, there's a few issues that you could think about. One is, you know, normally we'd like to have some sort of integrality statement. Yeah, why does this thing even take values in here, right? I'm dividing by the order of the group. Shouldn't I tensor with the rationals here, or at least invert all the group elements, or something like that? Yeah? So it's not at all clear from this definition why this should have any integrality properties. Yeah? Also depending, of course, on whatever ring we have here. Yeah? Second thing is, this is not at all clear from the first definition that applying it to this or applying it to that would give the same thing, because we have two different groups, and clearly this construction is highly dependent on the group. But let's draw here what we did sort of in terms of spaces. So we looked first, we started with our orbifold M mod G, a global quotient orbifold, and we somehow projected it down to this guy, just the one-point space mod G. Yeah? And then we went further from here to here. So here we have a map of G-equivariant spaces. We can think of this as a map of G-equivariant spaces, and we can apply everything that we know about G-equivariant cohomology theory, G-equivariant tomoisomorphisms, and so on. Yeah? And use transfer there. So this is a kind of transfer map along this map. And the second map you can think of as just a map of finite groups. And here you can think again, here's the point. So here you can think again of this thing. Well, you can apply BG going to B1, which is just a point. So the whole picture is, if you apply the Borel construction to the whole picture, it looks something like that. Hmm? Now, if you're willing to pass to the K2 local stable homotopy category, then you have a notion of duality. So this is some localization of the homotopy category. I will denote it by the duality in there by DK2. Now, duality you have in the stable homotopy category in all these localizations typically. But here you have something very special. You have that BG becomes self-dual. Hmm? Now, moreover, so this thing I have not defined what it is, and I'm not going to because it's a very long definition. But the point is that all these spaces can be mapped to that category. They can be interpreted as elements of that category. Hmm? The point is that if I apply DK2 to this map, BG goes to the one-point space, and let me add disjoint base points. Then this becomes a map from, this is the zero sphere, yeah? Also known as the zero sphere. Back in the other direction, from zero sphere to BG plus. And it's, if you calculate on characters, on these Hopkins-Kuhn-Ravenel characters, what it does, it's this map. Okay. This map here is this map. So if I apply DK2 to this whole thing, then this part will pull back. I apply DK2, the arrows turn around, but then I apply a cohomology theory, the arrows turn around again. Yeah? So this part is going to be this green map. 1 over G, sum over all pairs of commuting elements. And then, trace over these two. apply just duality to the first map, to this one, this is more or less what induces my equivariant genus. Okay? So this map here.
It explains
the integrality of the coefficients. It explains why it's overfold invariant, too, because now you just have the dual of this entire map. And while these two maps are clearly dependent on the final or on the presentation of the overfold, this map is clearly not. Yeah? So it becomes very somehow non-computational proof of these things, which are typically proved with more computational methods. Now, this is one way homotopy theory somehow sheds light, I would say, possibly on what's going on there, or maybe confuses us more, depending on how you want to see it. Now, I wanted to speak a little bit. Or maybe I will pause to see whether there's questions about this, because I feel like I rushed through this a bit. But if not, I wanted to speak just a tiny bit for the last few minutes about the setup and generalized moonshine, because I believe that that's another place where it will maybe become much more clear how it connects with physics. Here we have a story where we can say, wow, we discover formulas very much like this, and you can actually proves the stack of Mohr-Velinde-Velinde product formula in a very combinatorial way from this point of view of elliptic cohomology once you're able to speak about power operations. So power operations in K-theory would be exterior powers, symmetric powers, or Adams operations, things that you can apply to vector bundles. Yeah? In elliptic cohomology, there's analogs. They're defined in a very combinatorial way using these Hopkins-Kuhn-Ravenel characters, and you can just prove these kind of formulas, and actually you can prove these kind of formulas up for n tuples of commuting elements. Yeah? You can define what should be overfold genera at chromatic level n. They will involve n tuples instead of pairs, and you will have the same sort of Dijkhoff Mohr-Velinde-Velinde formulas there. No clue what should be the geometric interpretation of these things. Yeah? But from a homotopy theoretic point of view, proofs don't even get any more complicated. Yeah? Now let me speak about generalized moonshine. And also about a little bit about the work of Ginzburg, Kapranov. And again, this part should seem very familiar. So Ginzburg, Kapranov, Vassarou give axioms for what it means to be an equivariant elliptic cohomology theory. And the axioms that they give are, they basically say it should have something to do, or it should be described by moduli spaces of principal G bundles. Say G is a finite group for now, or for my purposes, because that's all we're interested in right now, over elliptic curves. And at least over C, you recover your pair of commuting elements as the monotomy. Around to generating circles of torus. And here you, of course, you connect to the sort of orbifold sigma models somehow, if you understand this. So they have sort of somewhat, it's not a geometric setup, because they just want to say that whatever rings turn up here are sheaves over the right moduli spaces and so on. They don't say really why geometrically this is happening, so, but they have these axioms. Now, in generalized moonshine, this is conjectured by Norton, which is a conjecture about pairs of commuting elements of the monster. Yeah? And you can actually, Norton doesn't phrase it like this. Norton is a group theorist. He doesn't speak about moduli spaces and all these things, principal bundles. But it can actually be translated into, there's a section. This is a conjecture, although widely, like, big parts are proved. But there's a section of a line bundle. An alpha over, and I would say in the second word, L alpha is over the moduli space or moduli stack, I guess, but it's a very harmless stack of principal G bundles, principal monster bundles over complex elliptic curves. Such that I give the section a name called F. You will be somehow able in the end to think about F as a complex valued function if you make some choices, but non-canonical choices. But the point here is that the invariance group, so once you fix G and H, the function F of G, H, tau, where tau is an upper half plane, has invariance group gamma such that there's a gamma prime sitting in gamma and an SR2Z. It is, well, whatever it fixes, like whatever fixes the, so G and H are fixed. Yeah. Now I could ask myself if I let SR2Z act on tau. Yeah. So send tau to A tau plus B over C tau plus D. Does it or does it not fix my function f? Yeah? You can even do it with SR2Q still. And it turns out that your sort of stabilizer group is, well, it has a common subgroup with SR2Z. Both of these have finite index. And the important part is that if you take your upper half plane and you divide it by gamma, you get a genus zero moduli space. Yeah? And this genus zero condition is supposed to be somehow the deep condition that people don't really understand what's going on there. Now, this is supposed to be a generalization of the classical moonshine scenario. And all of this, I mean, classical moonshine has been proved by Borchardt's, following this construction by Frankel, Lipovsky, Merman, and really what's at the heart of all of this is this monster conformal field theory. Yeah? But they like to think, the Moonshine people like to think in a very vertex operator algebra setup. And there is a paper by Ginsberg, Harvey, and Waffa, I believe, where they speak about the sigma model underlying this a little bit, but in a very physical language I don't understand very much. But I think actually that is something that would deserve some more attention because it could tell us a lot about the geometry of the setup. Mm-hmm.
And the paper of Jungbrück of Hanna Visserat, which year is that?
I think it's sometime in the 90s. And it's called, there's elliptic homology in the title. It's the only paper that has elliptic homology in the title.
The only one.
And it's called number one because they were planning to write a second thing, but I don't think it ever happened. Here, this genus zero condition, it is closely related though to a feature that, again, should remind you very much of elliptic cohomology. Namely, here these genus zero functions have to do with replicability. So what happens in classical moonshine? So classical moonshine should be related. Classical moonshine is what Borchardt's proved. Yeah? So the moonshine conjectures originally had just one element of the monster in there. And maybe I should say that these classical moonshine functions, they're oftentimes noted J sub G, and they're just going to be F of 1 comma G. It's J sub G of tau. And if G is 1, you get J minus 744, where J is the J function. Now, these hack operators and replicability are, again, defined in a very intertwined way. So let me define it in a circle, just to make... Or let me just define it just in the case of classical moonshine. It makes more sense. So here, if F is a... Or J is a classical... JG is a classical moonshine function. Then the nth hack operator is defined as follows. It's defined to be 1 over n, sum over all a times d equals n, 0 less than b less than d. Now we have here J sub G to A of A tau plus B over D. And this raising G to the eighth power is also known as the eighth Adams operation. Or this is the effect that the eighth Adams operation has on characters. Because if you think about one-dimensional complex representations, and you raise it to the nth tensor power, which is what's going on with the Adams operations, then if G was, say, a root of unity first, then it's going to be this to the power n afterwards. Mm-hmm. So it's the same as letting G to the power n, or G to the power a, act. Now, why are these things called hack operators? They're called hack operators because if you have the ordinary J function here, which is just J sub 1, then you have 1 to any power is again 1, so you have always the same sum here, j, but with different inputs. And this is the hack operator applied to the modular function j. Yeah? So people felt reminded of that formula, and they gave this thing the name hack operator. In fact, they went somehow to the trouble to somehow give a combinatorial definition of what it means to be replicable. So if you don't know that this thing is a moonshine function, you would say, oh, there exists some eighth replacement, eighth replicate of J that we could plug in here, such that this whole thing together becomes the 1 over n times the Faber polynomial, nth Faber polynomial of this. If you don't know what the Faber polynomial is, don't bother. So just sort of look at this formula to remind you of hacker operators. This is somehow believed to be at the heart of, not just believed to be, proved to be equivalent to the genus zero relation, a function being replicable. Yeah? We have proof that it's equivalent. And so one of the things that made me curious about this is that...
What's equivalent to what?
So a function is replicable, yeah? So a function f is called replicable if there exists functions fa. such that they fit in such a formula, which of course doesn't make any sense because we had used the right-hand side as the definition of the left-hand side. But here, there's something that you can always do, which is called the nth Faber polynomial. And I write JG, here would be F. You can do this if F is of the form Q to the minus 1 plus nothing plus A1 cube plus higher terms. Then there are these things called Faber polynomials, which basically are characterized by the fact that if you plug in your F, your power series F, that you get something of the form Q to the minus N plus nothing plus B1 cube.
Yes. That's how you calculate your test, right? So what's the statement about relation to...
That's how you what?
Right, so this is like in the usual case of Heck operators, right?
In München, you mean, or...?
In number theory, I mean. Now, how is it related to...
It's not at all the usual we have taken Heck operators.
It looks like it is.
Well, this formula looks very much like...
on this modular forms that you're writing.
If I have here J, right, if I don't have these replicates
right.
in there,
right.
right? So that's why people call it attack operators, because it looks very much like it, right?
Right.
But now here you have this combinatorial definition in there, that you have these replicates where you... I mean, this is a very combinatorial thing, right? There are some... You write it out with this Faber polynomial, and then there might or might not be some JAs that you can plug in, yeah? And so what was the theorem, or what was the thing to look at here was to say, oh, you know, Adams operators are something that turn up in K-theory. The chromatic level 2 analogs, their brothers, so to say, in elliptic homology, are Heck operators. Yeah? And how is this whole setup? So how can you describe this whole setup from the point of view of either Heck operators in elliptic homology, or Heck operators like you normally have them in number theory, where... what do you really want? You want to pull back along isogenies of elliptic curves, right? And it turns out that, yes, if you pull back along isogenies of elliptic curves and you pull back principal bundles over them with your isogenies, then you get exactly this formula. Yeah? If you do it...
Right, so this part of the board is, I think, clear to me. So what's confusing is how it's related to existence of this section. That was part of the...
That's a theorem, the very deep theorem that people in München proved, yeah?
But what's the statement about?
What's the statement that I'm trying to make here?
Yeah.
What's the statement? It's equivalent. With the three exceptions, these two things are equivalent.
So what exactly is equivalent? What existence
a function is
equivalent to what?
A function is replicable if a function sort of of this form Q to the minus 1 plus A1Q and so on is replicable. If and only the replicable is this involved definition that I didn't quite state properly, yeah? There exists some FAs such that they fit into such a formula. If and only if F defines genus 0, I mean the quotient by the invariance group of F of the upper half plane is genus 0. And there's three exceptions to that. Yeah? So very, very simple sort of functions which are replicable, but they don't. The sort of part that I was going to mention, but we're already well over time, so I'm just going to say it quickly, is that the notion of Heck operators that these people in München had, the notion of Heck operators, sort of the combinatorial notion of Heck operators that you had in elliptic homology, and the notion of Heck operators with isogenies, all these three things are the same thing, and are given by the exact same formula.
And I'm still confused actually, sorry for interrupting. So but here you have F which depends on G and H, two commuting elements.
Yeah.
And the definition for this iterator you wrote for one. So
yes, because I'm speaking here, this is in classical Münchheim.
Yes.
And so if I have here just G, I'm speaking about 1, G. Yeah, pair of commuting elements. So it's the untwisted sector. Classical
right.
Münchheim is the untwisted sector. Now
Okay.
Now you can define what would be Heck operators in generalized Münchheim.
Right.
Yeah? But it's actually so but in order to do this, you needed to want to actually look at isogenies and look at what Heck operators should be. You want to be pulling back along isogenies. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And the formula that you get there is a little
so but there is another statement, right? For the full case with two commuting elements.
Yes, there's you can define, like if you go ahead and you just define what should be hack operators using isogenies, yeah, or what there are in elliptic cohomology, coming from overflow loop spaces or something like that, yeah, then you get Tn of f of g h tau. I guess it should be like this. Yeah, equals 1 over n sum over all ad equals n 0 less to b less than d f of g to the d g to the minus b h to the a tau plus b over d. That's what happens if you have pairs. Now, if this guy F is a section in our line bundle L alpha, yeah, where alpha is actually a cohomology class in the fourth cohomology of the fourth integral cohomology of the monster, yeah, and the way you get the line bundle from that was described very nicely in the paper by Fried and Quinn at some point about Chern-Simons theories with finite gauge group. Now, but if you look at this thing and you set g equal to 1, what you should do to get classical moonshine, you see that you get 1, 1 times h to the a. So you get exactly the raising it to just the a power, and the other two you don't see anymore. Okay. Does it make
sense?
So this is the theorem, actually, that once you look at it, it's fairly simple, and once you know what you want to do, it's fairly simple to untangle it and sort of see that.
The theorem is that this replicability in this sense is equivalent to
the theorem is not as deep. Yeah, the theorem is just saying the proper definition of Hecker operators that you would want. Yeah, the one with isogenies and elliptic curves that gives you this formula. If you set g equal to 1, then you get this formula, the one that the classical moonshine people were seeing.
I can see that.
And if you speak about sort of overflow loop spaces and so on, look at the Hecker operators that people there look at. You get the same story again, and that's somehow in this K theory, in the Aquarian K theory, you get the same sort of, you get power operations. And again, these power operations are very much these cohomology operations, and the elliptic cohomology that we have are very much related to this formula of Dyckhoff, Mohr, Wallander, Wallander that I didn't speak about the connections today. Yeah? But basically what they say, what the formula of Dyckhoff, Mohr, Wallander, Wallander says in our book, so to say, is that the Witten genus, or the whatever elliptic genus you have, preserves power operations. Yeah, it preserves the H-infinity structure of your elliptic curve, which is known for almost all elliptic generalized contour up in the construction of TMF. Yeah? So you have a whole ton of different Dyckhoff-Mohr-Wallander formulas for different types of genera. Okay, I think this is enough. Unless there's more questions.
Yeah. Any more questions? So what would happen if you replace M principal bundle by some other bundle? Would you have an analogous conjecture, or?
You mean by other groups?
Yeah, like other M? Groups, other structure groups. So something more reasonable than M.
It is not clear to me. I mean, the thing that seems to be deeply connected to the monster is this genus zero condition. There's actually something where I wasn't sure, because Witten has recently started to write things about moonshine, but I can't really see, I haven't really looked at it very carefully, but I couldn't really see where the genus zero stuff was.
Well, in this new stuff there is no connection, but I was wondering maybe according to philosophy of say Mishka for other guys.
Yeah, you could put other groups, it doesn't even need to be finite. So people very much like to put S1 and then speak about rigidity and so on, or compact connected Lie groups or something like that.
So is there an analog of this side, or again, not?
Yes, I mean, because as soon as you have, I mean, you have everything apart from this genus zero thing, which is not so clear to me how it comes into the game, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, it's just not going to always happen that the moduli spaces in question that turn up are genus zero moduli spaces, right? So, because these are going to be components of your moduli space of principal G bundles, and it breaks up into things. And it turns out that somehow there's this mysterious property that the monster has, that if you take all the prime numbers dividing its order, then you get all the supersingular primes, and so you get all these, like, because it's connected to the relevant moduli spaces having genus zero, that you have these primes or product of these primes. And that's not just not true for other groups, so I doubt that it would happen. But I don't know anything much more. I mean, I think for these Münstein things, it's fair to say that a lot of things have been proved, but some things still remain mysterious or low proofed because they're proved by a big case-to-case analysis. But again, there's a person, Tuite, I think is his name. I don't know whether I'm pronouncing him correctly. And he's written about this genus zero condition from the physics point of view. And he seems to have a much more conceptual take on it than the mathematicians, but again, it's hard for mathematicians to understand what he's actually saying there because the language is different. I mean, this is how it's spelled. And there's a whole story with Hirzebruch's conjecture and the Witten manifold and so on. So Hirzebruch conjecture that there's a manifold 24 dimensional such that the Witten genus becomes a J function. And Hopkins and Mahovald found such a manifold by sort of tour de force and sort of surgery theory, homotopy theory. And a little bit, it seems, but the real thing that people would like would be a monster action on this manifold so that you get the whole Münstein story from it. And people have no idea how you would construct something like that. But it seems a little bit like, well, the way this is set up is that you have some sort of partition sum of some theory that gives you Münstein. It's just not the typical partition sum that you would have normally that would give you the Witten genus. But the way it's set up is still in such a way, I think the only reason why Hirzebruch shows the Witten genus is that you have a full SL2Z action rather than just some subgroups acting. Because that's what happens in Münstein. But here is again it's some sigma model with some partition function and fairly simple one actually if you look at this paper, and it turns out that you also have a full SL2Z action. You pick out the holomorphic part of the theory somehow, and it just works out. Yeah? So it's maybe not so clear. So maybe this conjecture by Hirzebruch should actually be revised, and sort of you should say, okay, we allow something that's not necessarily the Witten genus, but some sort of something that is a partition sum which wants to be some sort of elliptic genus. Yeah? But I don't know. This is speculation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So I'm doing a 3D gravity paper for he tries to find the partition functions for the C 4K. So there's
stop it.
Not yet.
Okay.
Something very similar to this replica formula because